I could either be the victim that the terrorists wanted and let the pain and the trauma that I just went through eat me up inside, or I could take that pain and do something.
The flag was hoisted before the world.
What does it mean, fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here we are.
Here I am.
Here I am with Shai Davidai.
My guest today is Sari Singer, the founder and director of Strength to Strength, an organization that supports victims of terrorism from all over the world through peer support systems. Sari.
Hi.
So nice having you.
So amazing to be able to sit with you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. And there's so many things that I want to delve into. but I'm going to start with the question that I start every episode, which is, Sari, what kind of a Jew are you?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. I mean, I think that I am a Jewish American. I think that my Judaism defines everything that I do in my life. And my connection to Israel has only been stronger and stronger every single day since I was living in Israel.
So let's get to that, living in Israel. So you grew up in New Jersey?
I did.
And in 2001, how old were you?
That's what you're asking me? 2001, I was working downtown, about two blocks away from the World Trade Center.
And
I overslept that morning and was not in my office and ended up calling downtown when I turned on the television and saw that the first plane had hit the tower. And I remember calling one of my colleagues and I heard screaming in the background and she said, "We don't know what's happened. The building shook. Don't come down here. We're being evacuated." And on that day, I realized we're not safe anywhere. If something like that could happen in New York City, felt like it could happen anywhere in the world. And I started having conversations with some of my friends in Israel. And then in December of 2001, I quit my job. And I led a birthright trip to Israel because I figured if I was going to go, I should be doing something productive on my way there and for 10 days. And then I started volunteering with organizations that were working with victims of terrorism.
This is 2001.
Yeah, the end of 2001, beginning of 2002.
And you basically started the process of making Aliyah.
I did. Before I left, I ended up going to the Sochnut, to the Jewish Agency's office, and I was told what forms I needed. I had to get a letter from my rabbi that I was Jewish and that my parents were Jewish and all the, I think it's the same thing that happens today, but it's so many years ago. I filled out a lot of the application. They still needed some information from me, but I had started the process when I first went there.
And what were these organizations that you were working with for victims of terrorism?
So I volunteered with an organization called One Family Fund. They were an organization that started after the Sparrows terrorist attack. It was amazing, actually.
I still tell people Sparrows terrorist attack was basically a suicide bomber walked into the Sparrow,
a pizzeria
in downtown Jerusalem.
Yeah. That was August 9th, 2001. So that was right before 9/11.
Blew himself up. And if I'm not mistaken, that night there was another suicide bomber that attacked the first responders that came.
Oh.
If I'm not mistaken.
So it's interesting. That day, most people don't realize why I was so impacted on 9/11. But on August 9th, that summer, I was running a summer program in Israel for NCSY. It was called Israel Summer Experience. It was a five-week touring program of Israel for high school kids. And that day, I went with one of the staff members to Jerusalem. The group was up north, and we were going to be in Sparrows for lunch. And I said, "Let's go get work done first." And when we ended up in the office in Har HaChutzvim, in the high-tech area of where we were going to get some work done, all of a sudden, within the first 20 minutes, our cell phone started ringing. And I got a phone call from someone up north saying, "Where are you?" And I said, "We're in the office." And they're like, "Thank God, there was just a terrorist attack at Sparrows." And I was like, what? Like, I couldn't even process what had happened. And then I found out a day or two later that my high school principal was in Sparrows that day. He was lightly injured, and his niece was with him, who was very badly injured, Tova Nachtenberg, Tova Feiner. And she was actually in a coma for 22 years. She just unfortunately succumbed to her injuries last year. But she had been in a rehab center for decades from that attack. And so it was really close to home because I knew people that had been directly impacted.
I remember that when she passed away from her coma, all of a sudden, the number of dead people, number of victims of the Sparrow attack went up.
Right.
That was the headline.
Yeah.
That was so chilling to think that someone who was attacked 2001 and the family going through all of that.
And then to be re-traumatized again 22 years later.
So you were working at volunteering with one family.
And then I also did some volunteer work for another organization, which doesn't exist anymore, called, it was Kids for Kids, which was working with kids in the old city with projects and stuff, just to, you know, if they were feeling the trauma just from what was going on at that time. Because that was during the Second Intifada when attacks were happening weekly all over the country, and especially in Jerusalem, there was a heightened alert very, very often. And I think everybody that lived there felt that tension and that, you know, everyone's sort of like, antennas were up to see what was around them, to be more aware of what was happening because of those things happening so often. And I think I also learned that often, that I was looking around no matter where I was, when I was on a bus, when I was walking, always aware of my surroundings. And if something didn't look right, you know, just to know what to do.
Yeah, I mean, during that phase, I had just graduated high school and actually joined the Navy, Israeli Navy.
Oh, wow.
My first Passover in the Navy was 2002. I was in basic training when the terrorist attack on
Park Plaza Hotel
in Netanya happened, and that changed. That marked basically what my experience in the Navy, I think,
wow,
all of my generation's military experience would be. So what was it like spending time in Israel those first, let's say, like year and a half?
So I loved it. I felt more at home there than anywhere else in the world.
And you were born and raised?
Born and raised in New Jersey. In Lakewood, New Jersey. You know, grew up connected to Israel through Federation and other things of like, you know, we have to help Israel, but never really feeling that deep, deep connection. I spent a year abroad after high school studying in Israel, and I loved it. It was a great year. I felt like it was a year to be with my friends and to learn and to, you know, to grow up a little bit. But I didn't really understand or feel this connection until I ran the summer programs for NCSY, because now I was seeing Israel through the eyes of teenagers that were like just sort of soaking up everything about the country. Like we would be hiking and we would be going on the country, and our tour guide would take out the Tanakh, would take out the Bible and show us where we're standing. And I just thought, like, I walk in the streets of New York and I never think about the famous people or what happened in history in New York. But here in Israel, every step I'm taking there is part of our history as Jews. And I would think about like how incredible. And I remember that last summer in 2001, I was reading a book on our bus, and my co-director was like, you know, saying to me, you're going to make Aliyah. Like he was so sure of it. And then 9/11 happened and I was like, I'm going, you know, and I really never felt more connected during that time to be there during the time when it was so sensitive. People were like, why did you come now? And I was like, how could I not? Like, I just felt more like I needed to be there. And I think there was no rhyme or reason, you know, 9/11, I think, made everybody rethink their priorities, you know, especially if you knew people that were downtown, if you worked downtown, and even the weeks and the months after 9/11, you still smelled the burning. You know, I would go to the office a month later and I still smelled those smells down there that I remember that first day when my window was open and I could smell them 100 blocks away when the attacks happened. And I think those situations sort of springboard us into the activism realm and what to do and where we want to prioritize our lives for the future. And I think 9/11 really was that pivotal day that changed everything for me in terms of what I thought I'd be doing in my perspective, and being there and volunteering and just being with the victims and hearing their stories and not understanding what they had gone through, but just being there to listen. That was the world to them, to know that somebody cared about them and that was wanted to be there during that difficult time. I remember them telling me, what are you doing here? You know, go home to your family. I'd be like, I want to be here. I'm here to be with you and to support you. And I was supposed to actually return to the States after 10 months. My money ran out. My parents, I called them and asked them to send me money. And they're like, no. They're like, we want you to come home. My mom used to say the TV was on 24/7 because she always wanted to see the news going on in Israel. She would call me. And
to be fair, like, imagine from your mom's perspective, her young daughter, right after 9/11 and during like a period where cafes, buses are being you know, attacked on a on like a weekly basis. She wants her daughter home and safe.
I think back then, I think when we're younger, we don't realize those things and we don't even comprehend it. I didn't even think about how my parents were feeling in this. And I feel bad about that now. I feel more guilt about it than I did because of what happened to me. I think giving them that anxiety and that craziness of me being there during a difficult time, I really didn't even have a thought about it. I just thought, this is what I need to do for myself right now. I think we're more self-absorbed when we're younger in terms of the me. And I think as we get older, we realize that it's more about the we and the differences of who we're impacting in our lives and not just about ourselves. Mm-hmm. I didn't really consider their feelings. Well, I said, I'm going. And so I had booked a flight in October to return in November of 2002. And then about 2 weeks before my flight, a friend of mine called me and she said that the school that she was working for was looking for an administrator. And was I interested in applying for the job? And so I did. I went on the interview, and a week before my flight, I canceled my ticket and I decided to stay.
You stayed in Jerusalem. Where were you living in Jerusalem?
I was living in Katzimon. It's a very Anglo area. Jerusalem. So it's very Anglo. I lived right down the block from the president's house and around the corner from the prime minister's residence. I lived on Palmach. I love that street. I love Katzimon. And I felt pretty safe. There's a lot of security around there. The school that I worked in was in Harnof, which is at the end entrance of the city. So I had to take two buses to get there every day. I took the 13 from Katzimon into town, and then I took the 11 into Harnof. And I really felt comfortable. I really felt like I was living in Israel. I wasn't just a tourist after those 10 months. I was now living life there. I had a job. I was still volunteering, and I was still taking advantage of every opportunity there. I felt like in Israel, for some reason, there's always more hours in the day to get more accomplished than I ever do here.
Well, we have to, because everything shuts down for a day and a half every week, so we gotta cram everything in.
Exactly. But yeah. I just always felt like I would go to work. I worked till 2 every day, and then I would go volunteer. And I think the volunteer really fed something in me. Like, I loved just being there to help, and I would go to the hospital visiting victims. I'd go to people's homes to visit them. Some of them I'm still in touch with today. I mean, a lot of them impacted my life in ways that they'd become really good friends. And then again, I continued to work and volunteer. And I remember, saying we need to do something. We need to make a bigger noise about what's going on in Israel. And I approached the organization. I said, my mom is constantly watching the news, and it says 10 people killed, 50 people injured. I'm sure the rest of the people are doing the same thing. Let's make a mission and bring 25 Israeli victims to the States to share their stories and let the people in the States hear from those that are really impacted. So I had some pushback originally, and then they said, okay, start planning. And so from February 2003 until June, I planned this trip where there were going to be 25 Israeli victims. Some of the biggest stories, actually, the grandson, the Park Plaza Hotel was owned by the Hamami family, and the father was the manager, and Itai Hamami was actually in the army at the time. We became really good friends, but Itai's father was killed, was murdered in that attack, and so that's a pivotal, that attack is so in my mind because I spent time with Itai and got to know him and to hear his stories, but also for him to help me through what I was going through. And so when I planned this trip, it was supposed to be all along the East Coast. The 25 Israelis were going to go to Washington, D.C. and meet with congressional leaders. They were going to go to Maryland, to Philadelphia, spend Shabbat in the Hamptons, in Livingston, New Jersey, in Deal, New Jersey. And the culmination of this 3-week trip, the Hope and Solidarity, was going to be a televised event with Mayor, at the time, Mayor Giuliani, who was the mayor during 9/11, and widows from the FDNY and the NYPD showing the solidarity between New York and Israel, that New York understood and Israel understood what each other had gone through. And the trip was going and we were planning it. And then all of a sudden, I remember we met the first week of June with everybody. And they were so excited that they were going to be representing Israel. Most of them had never been to the States before. And I remember one of the boys who was going, he had been in an attack. I don't know where it took place, but there were three friends. They were on a class trip. They were in the orchards picking cherries because a lot of the farmers didn't have help, because after the terrorist attack started, the Palestinians that were working for them, I guess, were no longer able to work at that time. So a lot of
which, by the way, and I think we should note,
sure,
because that's something extremely important to note. the people that the victims of of Hamas terrorism, of Palestinian Islamic Jihad terrorism, of PFLP terrorism, of Hezbollah terrorism, of Houthis terrorism, it's not just the Jews. Like, yes, the Jews are being targeted, but honest, good, hardworking Palestinian civilians
are suffering.
They couldn't go and work anymore.
Correct.
Because a suicide bomber walks onto a bus or a cafe or a pizzeria
and impacts their life and makes their again, the ripple effect of those things. And so these school kids were going and in the fields, and these three boys were walking back to the bus, and they stepped on some landmine that was left by the terrorists there and were blown up, the three boys. Wow. And one of the boys was very badly injured. He couldn't come on the trip with us. He was still in the hospital over a year later. But the other two boys came with us, and one of them said to me, "Are you coming with us?" And I said, "No." He said, "Why not?" I said, "Because I'm going back to the States to work for the summer so that way I can come back to Israel in the fall and be able to live here." And he said, "Oh, you should come. It's going to be such an amazing trip." I said, "I know." I said, "I planned the trip for you. I want you to have an amazing time." And in my mind, I was like, gosh, I wish I was going with them. Like, each story, each person was so incredible. Like, every single victim, and I want to say, like, the bereaved family members, the survivors that were there, there's no words. My friend Yariv Shabo, whose family, his mother and siblings were killed when terrorists came into their house at night. Like, every story I remember, and I just kept thinking, these amazing people that are going on this trip to represent Israel, and I'm not going to be with them. And then a week later.
So we'll get to a week later, but before we get to that.
Sure.
You spent so much time not just speaking, listening, but hugging and living with survivors of terrorism, with their families. What is that like? Like, you, just in these 5 minutes, you've mentioned so many different people that survived so many horrific attacks.
Yeah. I mean, I felt so honored to be around them, you know. At that time, I just felt like I wasn't doing that much. And I didn't realize the impact that I was making at that time. I thought, okay, I'm there, but, you know, I'm not doing anything different than other people that are volunteering. But I felt like it's what I needed to do for myself. But I didn't realize the enormous impact that just talking to somebody who's been through something, just connecting with them, does to help with the healing process. And I knew I was doing that because they said that. But, you know, you hear it and then you feel like, am I really, you know, sometimes you question, like, how much impact am I really having on these people? I knew the trip was a huge impact. I saw their faces. I saw the way we prepped them for what they were going to be encountering and the people they're going to be meeting with. And I knew that trip was going to be something huge. I didn't realize how huge that trip would impact me. Yeah. Because of everything.
So on September 11th, 2001, you slept in. You were supposed to go to work. Luckily, you slept in,
yeah,
and dodged that bullet. You were supposed to be in the Sbarro for pizza.
Yeah, I don't talk about that one that much, but yeah, it's crazy.
And you weren't there. What happened on June 11th, 2003?
Sure. So I actually, school ended on the 10th. So I knew that I had a little over a week until I was going back to the States, and I wanted to get a lot done. I had a bunch of meetings all over Jerusalem. And although I rarely took cabs, I knew that I wasn't going to make to any of my meetings on time by taking buses everywhere. You know how traffic is in Jerusalem. It's insane. And my meetings were like all over the city. So I ended up one by one taking a cab to each meeting. I was in Hebrew University for two different meetings. I had to be at Harachot Zvim, the high tech area, for a meeting. I went to town for a meeting, and my last meeting of the day was actually in Givat Shaul with a mentor of mine. And by the time I finished with him, it was about 2 o'clock. And he said, "What are you doing now?" And I said, "You know, I'm going to go to work for a few hours in the office." And he goes, "Why?" I said, "Because I'm right here. I'm right next to the office." He goes, "You have a few days left here. Go enjoy. It's gorgeous out." And I would say, like, June 11th, a lot of the weather reminded me of September 11th. Like, it was just a beautiful day in Jerusalem. And I said, "You know what? I'm going to go get work done. And then I have dinner planned, so I'll be fine." I went at the office, got there probably around 2:30. And I forgot that I didn't know had to get to dinner from Hanof because I lived in Katzimon and I was going to the German colony for dinner. And I usually walk there. So I called my friend and I said, what bus can I take to get from Hanof to Emek? And she said, you can catch the number 14 bus. You'll catch it at the Tachana at the bus station. And it'll take you right into Emek Rafaim. We were going to a place actually called Cafe Hillel. And it was my favorite place to go. I used to walk there in the mornings a lot before work and pick up lunch and take it with me. I was in there quite often. And so I ended up probably leaving work around 4 o'clock. I took the first bus, the number 11, to the bus station, but I couldn't find the 14 bus and it was driving me crazy. And I had no cash left on me. Because remember back then in 2002 and 2003, you couldn't use your credit card in the cab. So if you didn't have cash, you were kind of stuck. So I didn't want to stop at an ATM. So I kept looking for the bus and people kept directing me in the wrong directions. So finally I ended up finding the 14 bus, but now it was really rush hour. It was like closer to 5 o'clock and the buses were running late and the bus stop was really packed. And I'm sure you know what it's like to be at a bus stop with Israelis who want to get home at the end of the day to their families. But like, you know, that saying, "Ain savlanut," you know, that there's no
I'm getting on that bus. I don't know if you're getting on that bus, but I am getting on that bus.
So as much as I was a patient person before I lived in Israel, I feel like I started becoming Israeli that way. And like, I had no patience. And so I said, you know what, I'll hail a cab and I'll stop at the ATM at the entrance of Amec and take out cash from my account. And as I maneuvered through the crowd and went to put my hand out at the road to hail a cab, I saw the number 14 Aleph bus coming. And I thought, you know what, I have my chafshi, I have my bus pass. I might as well just get on and I'll just let her know I'll be a few minutes late, my friend Tani. So I ended up getting on the bus. I was exhausted. There were no empty seats. I ended up standing by the back door, which, as if anyone knows, the Eged buses, it's really the middle of the bus. And as we approached, I was on the phone with my friend as I boarded the bus, letting her know that I was going to be a few minutes late. And as I boarded the bus, the bus started moving. We ended up at Machane Yehuda. That was the next bus stop, the marketplace. And it's a crowded, you know, it's not just one bus stop, you know, it's 10 and 12 buses coming through. And I looked outside for a second. I saw hundreds of people outside waiting for buses. And I looked right in front of me, the two seats in front of me, right, the last row of the front section of the bus, these two people got off. And I said, you know what, I got to sit down. I'm going to sit down before anyone gets on the bus. And so as the woman, they got off, I sort of maneuvered onto those seats. Now, normally on the bus, it's interesting, at Machane Yehuda, I always think about, from my attack, the things that I did differently that we never know the decisions we make, those split second decisions, how much they can help us. Usually I used to take the aisle seat because if somebody would have gotten on with a lot of packages who was older, I would have gotten up for them on the bus. I don't know why, but I moved in next to the window seat. And I remember the girl who sat down next to me because she was with her boyfriend at the bus stop and he was holding onto the bars in front of our seats. And the bus started getting really, really crowded. Now, the reason why, and no one really knows this, the reason why I hardly sat next to the window is because when I studied in Israel for the year, I was on a number 2 bus and we were going towards the Western Wall to the bus stop and we got stoned at. There were rocks thrown at us and my window had broken, but it didn't break on the inside of the bus. It broke on the outside of the bus. So I never liked sitting on that window seat. So the fact that I moved in and sat next to the window that day, just, I don't know why I did it. It was definitely something I wouldn't have normally done. And then I remember the bus getting really crowded and the people outside trying to get on. The bus driver was like shutting the doors so that people couldn't get on the bus because it was getting too crowded. And then when I got the phone with my friend, I said, you know what? I don't want to hold my phone while everything's... My knapsack was on the floor. You know, the bus seats are really close together. There's hardly any room. But I ended up bending over a little bit and opening my knapsack. And as I opened the knapsack and dropped my phone in and went to close the knapsack, I felt this huge shockwave hit me. And the only way to explain what the shockwave feels like, it's like two pieces of metal that hit so hard against each other and vibrate back. That's what my body felt like. And I remember trying to lift my hands up to my face and the shockwave was pushing them down. And my body, even though I was bent over, my body was like all of a sudden being pushed towards the back of the seat. And because I was looking down when the blast happened, my eyes instinctively shut. Like I couldn't open them. So when the blast stopped and because I was leaning back, something had hit my left eye.
What is this blast? I think I want to explain to people what happened.
I mean, this 18-year-old Palestinian boy, and I call him a boy, who had been radicalized and indoctrinated on the Palestinian soccer team. He was the eighth kid that year that had been recruited by Hamas to carry out attacks against innocent civilians. And he strapped a lot of explosives on himself. He was dressed as a religious Jew, and he boarded that bus and to hurt and murder as many people as possible.
He blew himself up.
He blew himself
on
up.
This crowded bus.
Absolutely. And I didn't notice him. I didn't notice anything strange. It was during a ceasefire at the time, so there would be no reason to think that anything would happen. To somebody who was ultra orthodox, they would have known that there was something wrong apparently in what he was wearing. But this bus line, nobody would have probably even thought that there was anything unusual. And that blast literally I can't explain it to you except to say that because I'm inside the bus not knowing, I'm just feeling the shockwave. Somebody told me a few days later that they were on the other side of Davidka where the attack happened. He said he saw at the top of Yafo where the light is, he saw the bus blow up. He saw the bus jump 4 feet off the ground and come crashing down. Now, I didn't feel that, but that's what he said happened. And he was standing like definitely way across the street to see it, but it was close enough that he could see what happened. And when that blast stopped, so my left eye, something had hit it from the bus, and so it was completely swollen shut. And my right eye, I could barely open just enough to see the roof of the bus had fallen in, and the man's head in front of me wasn't moving. And after the blast, and I remember some of the survivors previously telling me this, so when it happened, I understood it, but there's a split second of silence after this blast. And it's not the silence that you hear outside in the summertime when the crickets are out. It's literally a split second, and it's the silence of death all around you. And as soon as the split second feels like much longer than that, but as soon as that split second is over, my ears started ringing really, really loud, and I started screaming. And luckily,
remember what you were screaming?
I was just screaming. I was just like a loud like scream, like the, and I remember because my throat was hurting afterwards. Like it must have been a really I don't even remember. I just remember screaming, like. I don't remember how long I was screaming. I just remember screaming. I didn't think it was a terrorist attack. I thought maybe we got into a bus accident or that somebody hit me in the face with something. But the last thing that I thought was that someone boarded that bus strapped with explosives to hurt and murder innocent people. And I remember screaming so loud. And I don't remember how long I was screaming. Now, I was awake the whole time. I just couldn't see anything. But some guy outside heard me screaming. And I found out later on that this guy was 3 blocks away. He heard the blast. He didn't know what it was, and he came running. Because in Israel, it doesn't matter if you're the police or the fire department or any first responder. Everybody comes running to help because everyone's in need and they want to help to save lives. That's really the essence of who we are as the Jewish people. That when something horrific and chaotic is happening, we don't run away from the problems. We run to them. This guy didn't know what happened. He was 3 blocks away. He didn't have to come to what was happening. But he came running towards that burning bus. And he said to me, you have to get out. And I said, I can't.
He heard you screaming.
He heard me screaming. He said, you have to get out. And I could hear him through the ringing in my ears. And I'm like, I can't. I can't. I just kept saying, I can't. And he said, you have to. He said, put your feet up here on the bar, which I thought was the window of the bus. And him and another man pulled me through this hole, which was really the bottom of the bus that had been blown out from the impact of the blast. And they brought me to the side of the road where this old woman was waiting with me. She wasn't the police. She wasn't Magen David Adom, but she was there waiting as if she were a mother waiting for her child to get help. And she kept asking me questions to keep me awake. And it's funny, you know, in times of trauma and the crazy things we go through, the things we say are just so telling. I found out, and I don't remember saying this, but she, I guess, found somebody in the hospital to check and see if I was okay. She went saying that she was with an American girl who kept saying, oh my God, my parents are going to kill me. They're going to make me come home from Israel. And that was like my first thought after all this.
What an interesting experience of just going through probably one of the worst experiences a person can go through. And then your reaction is, I just want to stay. My parents are going to pull me away from here.
That was the first thing I thought of. And it's funny because people were laughing in the hospital about it. Like they knew it was me because of how I would, all the other
you
things
that,
that happened.
American, Jewish American girl.
I was that American girl that like, and it's funny because, you know, the amazing part was, is I really learned the essence of the Israeli people and us as Jews, but really the Israelis and how amazing they are through this experience, because I'm alone in the hospital. I was one of the first people taken off the bus and I was put into an ambulance. And I remember I was yelling to them, I need my knapsack. Now, you're not allowed to take away things from an attack. That's evidence. And I said, I am not leaving without my knapsack, because for some reason in Israel, wherever I was, I carried my passport with me. And in my knapsack was my purse with my passport and my phone. And so I was not leaving, and I was being stubborn. And the woman in the ambulance was like, we need to get her to the hospital. And I'm like, I need my bag. And she's like, give me the bag. I remember this. And so my bag came with me to the hospital, which is never, ever happens during an attack. And I kept saying to her, "If am I okay?" And she said, you're okay. And I'm like, and I remember feeling for a second my side of my, I think I said my favorite shirt I was wearing a denim shirt, and I said to her, I think my shirt is ripped. And she's like, no, you're okay, because I didn't know the extent of my injuries. She's like, we just need to get you to the hospital and get you checked out. And the thing is that there are snippets of what I remember throughout the time of the attack, and there are certain things that are just pivotal to me. You know, I remember being brought in on the gurney. My friends actually found out that I was in the attack, because about a week and a half before, I went shopping with my friend Danit, and I bought this like very European shoes. I was known for like shopping for like these very clunky black shoes, and she saw my shoes on the gurney being wheeled into the hospital, and she knew it was me. Wow. And she called all the friends. She's like, I think Sari was in the attack.
What were the extent of your injuries?
So I was assessed by Dr. Avi Rifkin, who at the time was the head of the trauma center in Hadassah in Kerem, which is where I was brought. At that time, during the Second Intifada, the early part of it, all the most seriously wounded were brought to Hadassah in Kerem. I had shrapnel that went through my shoulder, breaking my clavicle bone. So shrapnel went in and out, like completely through. Both my eardrums were blown from the impact of the blast. My hair was burned. My face was burned and bruised. My legs were badly cut up from metal from the bus. I have shrapnel in my mouth that's inoperable, and that's lucky, because on that day, over 100 of us were injured on and off the bus, and 17 innocent people were killed, including everyone seated and standing around me. They approximated that from where I was seated, the terrorist was two people away, so they thought that he must have been next to the boyfriend.
So the girl that was sitting next to you
didn't make
it. Boyfriend that was
standing,
and then
the rows in front of me,
and then the Hamas terrorists.
Yeah. They assumed that from those that were murdered from the front of the bus, that he must have been right over there, because that's where most of the impact was, the blast.
The story that you just told me, in and of itself, would have been amazing if it just ended there. And yet it does not end there, because then you switch modes within 24 hours, 48 hours?
Yeah.
What did you do?
I mean, so first of all, I want to say the funny part of the American being in the hospital was
I should say.
Yeah.
You are a delight, and I love that you're able to say the funny part. But hard to find the humor.
I think that it's not humor in terms of the funny part. It's the irony, and it's also the idea that in the most horrific thing that happened to me in my life, I found so many amazing things within that experience that have determined my trajectory of where I am today. And that attack, as much as it's horrific, and every victim that goes through a terrorist attack, it's horrific, it doesn't define who I am. I'm much more than just that attack. It's something that happened to me. It'll always be with me, but it doesn't define who I am as a person, and doesn't define what I'm going to do in the future. And that I was very big about afterwards.
So you went from advocate to victim to victim advocate.
Yeah, actually, I've never heard it that way, but yeah, that's exactly what happened. The funny thing I want to share with you is that the Hadassah, the people in Hadassah who work there for the that work in the international realm, they found me in the hospital. And the funny part was is they noticed, they knew I was American because it's such an American thing. I think I had just come back. I'd been in the States previously, but I had nail polish on my toenails, and most Israelis. So they knew, they saw my feet on the gurney between the curtains, and they were like, that's an American. And so they came over and they were like, I didn't want the doctors or nurses to call my parents. And I was like, I don't want anyone to call my parents. And so I wouldn't let them until someone arrived that I knew. And so Barbara Sofer, who is the head of Hadassah International, she's like, we need to call your parents. And so I had her call my dad. Now, my dad at the time of the attack was and still is a New Jersey state senator. So at the time of the attack, he was the majority leader of the New Jersey State Senate. And like all good politicians in the month of June, he was on the golf course. And he got the phone call that I was in the attack. He was very lucky in the sense that he called my brother immediately. My brother worked for the prosecutor's office. He was an investigator. They both packed a bag and they ended up grabbing a flight to Israel. The governor at the time gave his helicopter and flew them over to JFK quickly. My mom, her passport was expired, so she couldn't get on the flight. So my dad and my brother were on their way over, but the hospital didn't know anything. I didn't tell anybody who my father was. None of my friends knew that my father was a politician. I never talked about it that much. My close friends in Israel knew, but
a politician, majority leader.
Yeah, but again, I was a child in the family who hated politics growing up. I didn't like being in the limelight. I didn't like people knowing. I liked to be a little private, even though that was hard. And so when what happened was I was waiting to go into surgery, and these people in Israel, like these Israelis who I didn't know, who had their own family members injured, they were coming in to check on me to see if I was okay. And I remember this old Tamani woman came in and she said, my son was a soldier on the bus. He's a few curtains down. He's injured. And he said to her, I got on the bus with an American girl who was talking on her cell phone. Go check on her. Maybe she doesn't have any family. And I thought to myself, this is an 18 or 19-year-old kid, never had a conversation with me, never even spoke to me. He's injured himself and he's sending his mother to check in on me. Because this is the essence of who we are. Another man comes in and says, my daughter was on the bus. She was seated behind the bus driver. She's in surgery right now. I speak English. What can I do for you? How can I help you? And I just thought in this most horrific time where I was all alone, I had all this family around me that I didn't even know existed. They were there for me. And I couldn't even thank them afterwards because I don't know who they are. They were there that day for a little while, and then I never saw them again. But they were there for me in a time where I needed them most. And the fact that they checked in on me, to me, was there are no words for that. And so as I'm waiting to go into surgery, and at this time, my father was called. My boss had showed up from the school that I worked in. This reporter comes in from an American newspaper and says, can I ask a few questions? And I always say it so nicely. My mom said afterwards, the one thing that didn't stop working after the attack was my mouth. And so, of course, I said, sure.
I love that.
And I don't really share usually what I said to the reporter, because when I did initially share when I first came back, I got a lot of criticism. But I'm going to share with you what I said, because I think it's important for people to hear, especially at this time with what's going on in the U.S. and around the world for Jews. He said, how do you feel after being in a terrorist attack? I said, I'm angry. And this is in trauma and shock. I'm still in that shock mode. I haven't gone into surgery yet. I'm still injured. I'm waiting. And in Israel, what happens is, at the time of the Second Intifada, the terrorists wanted to make sure that they had maximum impact. They wanted to kill as many people as possible. So a lot of times, besides the bomb on the vest, they would glue nuts and bolts to this vest. But before doing that, they would dip it in rat poisoning. So that way, if the nail didn't kill you, the rat poisoning would. So when you come into the hospital after attack and they thought a nail went through me, that it was that size, like that big, they didn't know if there was rat poisoning or not. So there's a window of like 5 or 6 hours to go into surgery of where you have to, you know, where has. So I was the last, I went in at that last point, almost into 6 hours. I went in around 11 o'clock at night into surgery. And I think the attack happened somewhere around 5:30. So when that maximum impact, so they want that to happen. They want to make sure. So I'm waiting still. And I'm in this like state of I don't know what. And he's asking me these questions where usually when a normal person's going to answer questions, you're going to think about what you're saying. I had no filter. I didn't think about anything. I said, I'm angry. And he said, who are you angry at? I said, President Bush. I said, I voted for him and I trust him and he has no idea what it's like to be an American living here. And he needs to come here and talk to the Americans who've made Aliyah, not just the politicians.
I should pause for a second because it's important to note that this wasn't a political argument for you.
No.
Your dad was the majority leader of the Republicans in state Senate in New Jersey.
Correct.
Your dad is and was a Republican.
Correct.
Bush was the president that you had voted for. You
and
were criticizing him not as a politician. You were criticizing as the leader.
Correct.
In the same way that I've heard you now, years later, criticizing Biden for not knowing, and Kamala Harris as his vice president, for not knowing what it like. They know the facts, they know the statistics, they do not know what it is like.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I don't care what party you are. When I'm an American, anywhere I am in the world, my president and my government should be protecting me no matter what. And at that point, that attack happened because President Bush had put a peace plan on the table, and this was Hamas's answer to that peace plan. And so I felt when in this mode of, like, again, trauma and shock, I just felt like, you know, I wasn't protected. I wasn't taken care of. This should have never happened. And so at that point, when I said that and made that comment, my boss pulled aside and said, by the way, her father's a Republican state senator. And boom, the media like ate it up. Israel said it was the best Hasbara, the best PR they had in years. And at that point, the hospital went into sort of like a damage control because now all the media wanted to hear what I had to say and they didn't know anything, because when you walk into a hospital in Israel, the politics go out the door. Every human life is precious. No one knew if I was Jewish, if I was Christian. No one knew where I was from. No one knew anything about me except
other than
that
the toenails.
Other than the toenails.
So, like your mom said, your mouth didn't stop working, but your brain also didn't stop working. Because how soon after that did you found Strength to Strength?
So it took me a little while there. So just one quick thing to share with you. So when I got out of surgery at around 2:30 in the morning, I then did a press conference before my dad arrived with about 30 international television stations.
Wow.
So my mind was working even though I didn't realize it, because I realized at that point I had two choices. I could either be the victim that the terrorists wanted and let the pain and the trauma that I just went through eat me up inside, or I could take that pain and do something with it. And that's why I agreed to do the press conference, because I realized that I had an opportunity to be a voice for Israel and be a voice for all the victims that were on my bus that day. And so that's why I did it, not thinking about the politics or anything else, just knowing that if I can share my knowledge and what happened to me and it helps another victim, that was the most important thing to me at that point. And I remember doing the press conference, you know, really, I remember a woman who I worked with was with me, and I would only do the press conference on two conditions. I had to be seated up. I didn't want to be in bed because I didn't want people to think I was the victim. And I had to be covered. I didn't want people to see my injuries. So my arm had been in a sling, and I wanted to be covered completely because I didn't want anyone to see, like, I mean, they saw my injuries on my face, but I didn't want them to see my other injuries. And she said to me, squeeze my hand when you've had enough. And I remember about 15 minutes into the interview, I squeezed it and she, that was it. Like, I was done. And CNN had ended up coming late and they wanted to interview, and I said no, I wouldn't interview with them, because I felt like their what they were saying about Israel was inaccurate, and I didn't like the coverage I was seeing on the news.
They could show up on time.
Right.
If they cared, they could have showed up on time.
They could have. And then 2 days later, my dad got a phone call in my hospital room from Wolf Blitzer, and my dad said, you don't say no to Wolf Blitzer, please do the interview. And again, I said, I'll do the interview on one condition, if you do the interview with me. So my dad actually did the interview with me. And I did agree to meet with them. Again, wanted to be seated, not laying in bed. And I spent almost 2 weeks in Hadassah. I was there for 11 days.
Look, there's something, and I want to point out to the audience. Most of the audience have never and hopefully will never go through this kind of experience. But there is a lesson here where, you know, you have a choice at every given moment of your life to either be the victim or the survivor, either be the person that the victim that the attacker wants you to be, or the advocate that goes and says, not only will I not be the victim, but I will also work so no other victims will ever be. And it doesn't have to be a terrorist attack. If something as small as like being called a kike on campus to a, you know, being spat on the street to being blown up in a bus.
Absolutely. I had no control over what happened to me that day. The only control over I have is how I live my life going forward. And I made a decision that I want to live that life showing love and kindness instead of the hate that that day was all about. I could have very, very, you know, there are many people after a terrorist attack that become angry and resentful and have that. I didn't want that. That day was all about hate. I feel like I experienced one of the worst hates possible in the world. And I think that looking at it, when I say that right now, today, the hate and the perpetuation of the hate that I'm seeing today on our college campuses and in New York City and everywhere in the world. I was in London this summer. I saw the hate that we're seeing. That to me is the worst hate that I've seen in such a long time.
As someone who survived a suicide bombing in the Second Intifada, what goes through your mind when you hear Columbia students and people in downtown New York and London and all around the world screaming, "Globalize the Intifada"?
So I for me, it's definitely, I mean, October 7th was a huge re-traumatization for me. I had just experienced the year before my 20th anniversary of my attack, and that was a very difficult year. And thank God I have great support system, and the victims that I work with, a lot of the 9/11 survivors said to me, you know, the 20 year going into it is really hard. So I knew that, but I thought after the 20 year I was going to be great. I was just starting to get myself back to normal. I had just been in Israel for the first time on the anniversary of my attack since the attack happened. So 20 years later, I went to Israel on that date. I made a Sudas Hoda'a. I had 68 of my friends and family. I made dinner at a restaurant with them and celebrated and remembered the lives of those 17 innocent people that were on my bus that day. And I thought I was finally, as the Chagim and as Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur passed, I thought, okay, I'm in a much better headspace right now. And then October 7th happened, and I was beyond re-traumatized, as many of our victims were. And I was actually at home in Lakewood with my family for that Shabbat and that end of the holiday. And I slept late that morning, and my Garmin was next to my phone, and I see my phone ringing, and I see one of my friends who survived a terrorist attack in 1995 in Israel, and I see her name come up on my phone, and she's Orthodox, and I'm like, why is she calling my phone on Shabbat? And then I see my Garmin light go off, and it says Israel at war, and I pick up my phone, and she had gone to shul, and she went to her rabbi and said, I need to call somebody. I'm re-traumatized. Like, she also, and she called me. She's like, I had to call you. From that point on, through the next 2 days, I'm on WhatsApp with all of our victims.
So let's get to that. What is Strength?
Sure. So I came back to the States, and there was no support for me here. I had nowhere to. I had all the support in Israel. I lived in Israel a year after the attack. I still volunteer with the organizations, but I still was connected with victims, and they were my support system. And the victims I met in Israel, they saved me. They helped me to process, especially that 3-week mission that I planned I went on. And I spent time with those families, and they helped me to understand, to process what I was going to be going through and how to manage things moving forward. And I was so grateful to that. But a year after the attack, I had to come back to the States for some ongoing medical issues. And when I got back here, there was nobody for me to connect with. And so I reached out to one of the 9/11 groups, and they said I wasn't a 9/11 survivor, so I wasn't able to join them. So I Googled Americans and terrorist attacks in Israel, and I found two names of two Americans that were in the Mike's Place terrorist attack 6 weeks before my attack, April 30th. And I reached out to them. And that was the beginning of me realizing that so many people don't have support. And it wasn't just me. And so I started reaching out to organizations in Europe and connecting. I was brought in to speak to a number of victims' conferences. I was brought in to speak in London and Madrid on the anniversary of the Madrid bombings of March 2004.
So you were speaking, just to know, you were speaking about terrorism regardless of who the victims were?
Correct.
Jews, Christians, Muslims, and regardless of who the terrorists were?
Correct. Absolutely. I don't care. I don't differentiate between Hamas, Hezbollah, Boko Haram, El Shabaab, ISIS, Al-Qaeda. They're all the same to me. They all have the same goal, and they all have the same agenda, and they're all funded by the same the same regimes. So I start.
Do you differentiate between Jewish victims, Christian victims, Muslim victims?
No. The largest group in the world that's impacted by terrorism are Muslims. And I don't differentiate. Any civilian victim of terrorism, it is a part of my family. They become part of my family. We've all joined this club that none of us asked to join. But the thing I can say out of the worst experience is I have all these people that are amazing and incredible that have impacted my life in ways that I could never imagine. And I don't think that their trauma is any different than mine. What I love about our Strength to Strength and what we do is that there's no difference between what I went through in Israel and what happened in Paris or in London or Madrid or Brussels or anywhere else in the world. Terrorism is terrorism. And that is terrorism in Israel. And it is no different. And people have said comments to me that are really awful saying that wasn't terrorism. You know, that was Israelis occupying, you know, the land that belongs to Palestinians. Like, no, I was a civilian on the way to meet a friend for dinner. I was blown up on a bus by a suicide bomber. That is a terrorist attack. Hamas took responsibility for my attack. That is no different than any other terrorist attack in the world. And so we don't differentiate. A victim, a survivor, a bereaved family member, a first responder, all the same to us. We all are dealing with our own traumas. But how better is it for us to be able to do that together? The peer-to-peer support piece, which is huge. And that's what I started doing. I realized that there was nobody connecting all these organizations. So I founded Strength to Strength in 2012 with the idea that we are all volunteer-driven. Every single person that works with us is volunteer, and we work with organizations on the ground, NGOs that are working with the families of the victims of the terrorist attacks in 17 different countries. So we will only work in a place where there's an actual nonprofit that's working with the civilian victims. And we run events, we run weekend retreats, we do stuff for anniversary ceremonies, we do conferences, we do peer-to-peer support events, we have a mentorship program. We have a program that we run called the Young Ambassadors Program, where we bring young people ages 15 to 20 from different countries to New York for a week of healing. And they build a global peer support group. And that's the idea of Strength to Strength. We are a global peer support group for civilian victims of terrorism, knowing that any victim should never feel like they're alone. No one should feel like I felt when I came back to the U.S. that I had nowhere to turn to. And I feel very blessed that I have two parents that are very strong people, and they instilled in me always from a young age this idea of creating and seeing a problem and how to solve it. And Strength to Strength was the solution to a problem that I saw. And so it's a little selfish, maybe. I started an organization because I was looking for something that I couldn't find. But we've really helped so many families around the world. And I'm still helping. I just got off, you know, the last 2 days I've been with victims from 9/11, with the families, survivors, bereaved family members. And I feel like I'm lucky. They keep thanking me. I'm like, no, I'm thanking you.
Who do you have over tonight for Shabbat dinner?
Shabbat dinner tonight is actually a little different. So there are a number of our members that came in to support our 9/11 family during the anniversary, which is always very special. So I have two survivors from the Manchester Arena bombing coming for dinner tonight. I've got a survivor from the London Westminster terrorist attack in March of 2017. I have a 9/11 survivor coming with his wife and daughter and son-in-law. And then I've got two of my friends coming for dinner. And, you know, to me, that's the best way for us to have gone through a very difficult week and then to sit around having a Shabbat meal that really encompasses everything that Strength to Strength instills, bringing people together, us being able to enjoy and realize the important things in life from the horrific things that we've experienced, and knowing that we as survivors and even the bereaved family members, we don't just sit around and talk about our trauma and what we went through. There's a lot of laughter and a lot of fun and a lot of camaraderie and strength that we get from each other. We just had a pre-9/11 dinner on Tuesday night here in the city. And we usually do it at a private residence, but our donor couldn't do it. So we went out to a restaurant in the city called Time and Tonic, which I highly recommend to everybody. I love that place.
Really owned.
It is. Sure. Gluten-free. I love that about it. And the food's delicious. And so they had like a semi-private room and they were wonderful. They couldn't do enough for us. And before we were able to get into the room, a bunch of them went over to the bar to sit and have some drinks. And then I went over and I said, you guys go inside, you know, you can take your drinks with you. And there were these three young girls sitting there, you know, also having drinks. And I said, did they tell you why they're here? And they said, no. I said, they're all survivors of terrorist attacks. What, 9/11? I said, London. They were like, really? They said, they're so happy. They're so fun to be around. She said, we never would have thought. I said, because that's the amazing thing here is that through these horrific things, we see the good in life. We see the things that we need to celebrate. And while it is hard before 9/11, and especially for our survivors to celebrate because they're also thinking about the people and their colleagues that didn't survive, they still can bring about joy to the other people around them. And I thought it was so incredible that these young women said this to me, because I actually told the group afterwards, because this is what we're all about, is to show that we are stronger together, that we bring each other this life and this love, even through something so horrific.
So before we end, I do want to ask you about one last thing.
Sure.
So 2003, survived a suicide bombing. 20 years later, you feel re-traumatized by October 7th. And you go into action mode, you help other people in your network, Jews and non-Jews who are being re-traumatized. Then fast forward to September 2024, six Jewish hostages were executed by Hamas, including one Jewish American, Hirsch Goldberg, Poland. I organized a vigil, a rally, a get-together, I don't even know what to call it, outside of Colombia. And you texted me, said, I'm coming, I want to speak. I haven't spoken since October 7th. Why? What happened? Why then?
So first of all, it's interesting that I hadn't spoken at any rallies, or I hadn't written an op-ed or anything about October 7th. Part of me felt like I'm the old victim, and like, how can I talk about like what I'm feeling, what I'm going through, while so many Israelis that went through October 7th are speaking out about their experiences. And I did reach out to a number of them, and I messaged some of them, and I met some of the survivors of the Nova Festival and had dinner with them, and just said, I'm here if you need anything. Like, I remember when I went through what I went through, the best thing for me was an older victim coming to me and saying, I'm here if you need to talk. So that's what I did. But I sort of stayed away from talking about it publicly because I felt like it's not about me, it's about them. But then I realized, and I've been realizing this over the last few months, that what happened October 7th is a global trauma, a communal trauma for the Jewish world. It wasn't just about what happened in Israel that day. It's affected so many Jews everywhere. And I spent time in London this summer and talking to the communities there. And I was in Israel, and I went down south to be able to witness what happened, and to be able to bring gear and stuff to some of the soldiers and to give them support and to let them know that we're there, and that I, as an American who live in the U.S., are standing by them and want to be there for them. When you announced the vigil, well, when the news came about the six hostages that had been murdered, my heart sank worse than it had at any other point, because I had been praying. I mean, there are a few of the hostages that I connected with in terms of their stories and their families, and one of them was Hirsch. And even though I didn't know his parents, I have friends that know them, and friends that, you know, are friends with them in Israel, but even friends that know them from before they moved to Israel. And so I always felt connected to that. And so I just felt like I thought he was coming home, and I thought they were all coming home. And when that happened, I just was like, I need to do something. And when you announced the vigil.
I still sometimes think that he's coming home. I can't.
I know. It's so hard to, it's hard to even like talk about that, you know, when you're a survivor. And again, I never felt survivor's guilt from my attack. I didn't know anybody on my bus. I did feel it once when I met the family members of the American that was killed on my bus. About 6 years later, I met the mother, and I did feel it. Like, I walked into their house and she's like, Sari, I'm so happy you're alive. As she's in a wheelchair holding this big picture of her son on her lap that didn't survive. And I didn't know him, but that was the first time I ever felt survivor's guilt. I hadn't felt a survivor's guilt in a really long time. I'm sure many victims feel this way that survive, but the question always becomes is why am I here and why is somebody else not? And I think after October 7th, that was so much in my head, more so than any other previous year, any other attack, because it was so huge and so impactful to so across the globe. It wasn't like, you know, a terrorist attack happened during the Second Intifada and then a few days later, everything's back to normal in Israel. You know, they get it quickly, everything. It hit so hard when those six were murdered brutally the way they were. And I was like, when I heard, and you know how much respect I have for you and everything you're doing. And I just feel like when you announced that vigil, I was like, I have to go, even if I'm afraid. And I was nervous to be there. Even if I'm afraid to be there, if Shai's there and he's standing up, I need to now stop being afraid to use my voice. I know my voice is strong. I know it's powerful. And I know the things I say have meaning, but I need to stop thinking that I shouldn't be talking out at this time, because just because my attack happened 21 years ago, the answer should be is, Hamas is still doing this 21 years later. We need to have all our voices out there from all the decades that Hamas has been doing this to try and stop them and to make some movement in the world for the world to realize that this was not an isolated incident. It was a major thing that they'd been doing over and over again. You're just hearing about it now because it was much larger than any of the other attacks.
And I think one of the most emblematic moments of that rally that we held was as you were talking about being a survivor of Hamas's suicide bombing in Jerusalem, someone walked by, started screaming, yes, free Palestine. And look, you have the freedom of speech to say whatever you want. And I believe that certain parts of the Palestine, our Palestine, should be free and state and it coexist with a state of Israel. Maybe that person doesn't believe it. I don't care. But when you scream at or while a survivor of a terrorist attack is telling about her experience, it shows that there is no moral equivalency, that there is right, there is wrong. And at that point, we were on the right side.
Great, agreed. And that vigil was incredible because it really strengthened me a lot to realize that I have to be speaking out more. And I can't think, well, I'm the old victim and it's not my place, even though these young victims are now the new victims sharing. We need to share with them. We need to let them know that we're supporting them. So
I'm really sorry that I have to cut this. It's not even short because we've been talking for an hour, but I have so many other questions for you. But just for the sake of time, I like to end this show, every episode, with what I've been calling the Jewish lightning round, a series of questions. There's no right or wrong answers. You just answer with the first thing that comes to mind. Sure. You get one pass. I get to tell you if you get that pass. Dari Singer, what is one thing people don't know about you?
One thing people don't know about me? That I really love my time alone.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That we're the most passionate, loving, considerate, amazing people in the world.
What is your favorite curse?
Pass. I can't say that publicly.
When was the last time you cried?
Last night.
If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
I'd love to have dinner with Golda Meir.
She's been mentioned by so many people. So interesting. I need to delve into that. What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Oh, that's so hard because I love Pesach, but I also love Sukkot.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
My least favorite Jewish holiday? I don't think I have one. I think the meaning behind all of them is important.
When do you feel safest? When do you feel least safe?
Right now in New York City, I feel the least safe that I've ever felt.
What gives you hope?
Oh, well, there's a lot of things that give me hope. I'd say that people like you give me a tremendous amount of hope. I think that, and even at that rally, I think Shabbos Kestenbaum, I think these Jewish leaders, these young people that are fighting the fight on college campus, give me so much hope. Eyal Jacoby. I mean, I could go, you know,
yes, please include me in the list of young people. You and I are probably the same age, and I love it that you'd include me with them. What is the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the words Jewish civil rights?
Oh, I mean, it's weird because that when you say Jewish civil rights, I just think about like the establishment of the state of Israel and like, and it shouldn't be. That's not what the Jewish civil rights are. But no, that's what I feel like. I feel like that's the beginning of everything for the state of Israel. So I guess that's what I.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
I would love them to donate to Strength to Strength. I would love them to know that every dollar that they donate to us directly goes to our programs. We're working on a lot of stuff for stuff going on in Israel, but we're also working for a lot of victims that have been in attacks from decades ago, and they still need support. And it doesn't stop just because another attack happens or another thing happens. Doesn't mean that the people that haven't been through it previously, you know, people sometimes think that, you know, that you're fine after a year or two. True. So I would say if people could donate to us and help support the work that we're doing, I'd be so grateful.
Sorry, where can people find you?
They can go to our website, stosglobal.org.
stosglobal.org.
And I'm always willing to help anybody. I speak at a lot of places. Anyone asks me to speak, I'll never turn someone down. I think that my story is not just my story, but the story of thousands and thousands of Israelis that have been impacted by terrorism over the decades. And my story is their story. So I think it's really important that people hear our stories and remember that this is not just October 7th didn't just happen, that for decades Hamas has been murdering and injuring innocent people.
So what can I say? You didn't just survive. You are a survivor. You are the embodiment of what resilience and Jewish resilience is, sounds like, looks like. And I am so grateful to be able to say that here I am with Sari Singer. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."